This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You need surgery.
Bisexuality.
Bisexual.
I'm bisexual.
Bisexual.
Triple bypass.
Bisexual.
Bisexual.
Bisexuality.
Bisexuality.
The best of both worlds.
Triple bypass.
Triple bypass.
Triple bypass on Joy 94.9.
Hello, good evening, welcome. It is 9 o'clock. It is the last Tuesday of the month, which means it must be time for the representation hour for Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. Thank you once again to the Urban Dreaming crew for a fantastic show. My name is Jennifer. Allow me to tell you the way things are. So tonight, rather than looking at contemporary pop culture, I want to have a chat about how Shakespeare is queer as heck, both the man and the genre. Now, full disclosure, I am working on a show at the moment called Ophelia Thinks Harder. It opens in just over a week. Check out witinc.com.au for details. It is based on Hamlet, and so I have Shakespeare on the brain. And it's got me thinking again about just how many glorious examples of queer men and queer love we get in Shakespeare's stories. And I often lament the lack of wholesome, joyous MLM affection in contemporary pop culture. So bugger it. Let's go back 400 years. What could possibly go wrong, right? So to kick us off tonight, I think it's only fair that we listen to Shakespeare's sister. You're on Joy. Shakespeare's sister telling you the truth there with your history. Hi, I'm Jennifer. This is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass on Joy. And tonight we are talking bi-plus characters in Shakespeare plays. But let's start off by talking about the man, the myth, the legend, the massive queer Shakespeare. There's a whole lot of debate about whether Shakespeare was bisexual or not. We know he was married to Anne Hathaway. We know they had three kids. We know he left her his second best bed in his will, which is actually really lovely because that's the one they slept in. But the speculation is around who else he did the business with. It's mostly based on the Dark Lady sonnets. We, of course, know Sonnet 18, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate." What we don't know is that that sonnet was dedicated to the Fair Lord, not the Dark Lady. And there's a whole lot of speculation over who he might have been in love with. The two front runners are Henry Wriothesley, who was the third Earl of Southampton, and William Herbert, who was the third Earl of Pembroke. So apparently the main criterion was to be a third Earl. I don't know what was wrong with the second Earls or the fourth Earls, but there you go. But in Sonnet 20, we get Shakespeare referring to the master mistress of my passion, which sounds to me as though he is alluding to the love that a man might feel for a woman in a heteronormative world being felt instead for a man. The plot thickens. Mm-hmm. Does it thicken, or can we just accept that somebody who wrote as lovingly and romantically for the Fair Lord as he did for the Dark Lady, and somebody who wrote a bunch of male characters who loved both men and women, was possibly a wee bit queer? Now, some of the arguments against are things like, oh, well, in Elizabethan times, there was a lot of homo-romantic feeling accepted in friendship, and that's cool, but we didn't actually see a lot of it in plays and storytelling, certainly not as eloquently as Shakespeare does it. So let's do a bit of digging, huh? See what we can find. You are with Jennifer. This is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass, and of course you're on Joy.
Lonely wife, you count up the years and they will be filled with tears.
There with Young Hearts Run Free, most beautifully presented in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet. And that is the next topic of conversation. You are on Joy. This is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass. I am Jennifer, and tonight we are talking bi plus characters in Shakespeare stories. And oh my word, there are a lot of them. So let's carry on, shall we? So, Mercutio. Anybody with a bi plus bone in their body, possibly, probably, maybe, certainly I did, read Romeo and Juliet in high school and thought, yeah, okay, this guy's got a bit going on, doesn't he? I mean, aside from the fairly flagrant misogyny, he does refer at one point to Romeo sitting on the ground wishing that Juliet had an open arse. If you don't believe me, look it up. If you can't find it, fight me. But it's more than that. Mercutio is this central character trapped between the two families. He's not Capulet. He's not Montague. He's not gay. He's not straight. He is connected to both families and yet separate from them. And even if it's metaphorical, he's the most glorious example of a bi-plus character. His death is the fulcrum of the entire story. It's that moment at which Romeo is banished, but Romeo has accidentally killed a man he loves. Oh. So let's have a look at Baz Luhrmann's interpretation. Now, there's a whole lot wrong with this play, with this movie. We know. But I want to talk in particular about the party scene. In the party scene, we have everybody dressed almost as their true character, or as the character that the world sees them as. So we get Tybalt dressed in his devil horns. And, oh my goodness, John, you did a beautiful job there. We get Lady Capulet dressed as Queen of the Nile because she is queen of the party. We get Juliet dressed as an angel, alluding to Romeo's, "I'll speak again, bright angel, for thou art as is a winged messenger of heaven," and all of those little lines he says. We get Romeo dressed as a knight, possibly reference to Juliet later calling him my true knight, or, you know, maybe we get a little bit of a double entendre because Juliet later on says, "Come, gentle knight." We're getting a bit grotty there, Baz. But Mercutio comes out in this glamorous white sequined brassiere and accompanying tight curled white wig. Mercutio is the central performer in this bacchanalian carnival. Mercutio is the thing that makes the party work. The other thing Baz Luhrmann did is decided to cast Mercutio as African-American and decided to make the two warring families Anglo and Latino, which means that Mercutio is once again neither one or the other. He is in every way caught between two ideas. Now, some people have claimed that Mercutio's cross-dressing is evidence of his trans identity. I would say that cross-dressing and trans identity are very, very different things. And Mercutio never seems to claim to be anything other than a dude. But he does sit in that world in between two ideas. So whether he is gender fluid, whether he is not, I would say at the very least Mercutio is gay, but it's very, very much more likely that Mercutio is bi, you know, drawing his sword during the fight. What do you think? Send me an email, send me a tweet. We are triplebypass@joy.org.au, or you can find us on Twitter at triplebypass. I'd really love to know whether you see the queer in Mercutio. You are on Joy. This is the representation hour for Triple Bypass. I am Jennifer, and I'll be back in a sec with a whole lot more queer Shakespeare. Oh, aren't you lucky? Welcome back. This is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. It is the last Tuesday of the month, which means we are talking all things Bi Plus. I am Jennifer, and tonight it's all about Shakespeare. Shakespeare and his beautifully bisexual bevy of blokes. Let's have a chat about Antonio. Which Antonio, you might ask? Every Antonio, I might answer. Well, let's gloss over Antonio and Sebastian in The Tempest. Look, they're basically jerks. I don't know if they're in love with each other or not, but they don't really learn anything. They don't show any remorse by the end of the show. They don't ask for forgiveness. You know, they're jesting with words is kind of fun, but anyway, let's just leave them in their box. They can do what they need to. Their private life is none of our business. But what is our business is Antonio and Sebastian in Twelfth Night. Oh, my wordy. Antonio says to Sebastian, "If you will not murder me for my love, let me be your servant." And Sebastian says, "If you will not undo what you have done, that is, kill him whom you have recovered, desire it not." Oh, oh, if you won't kill me, then let me love you. Yes, but only if you let me love you. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. And then Antonio gives Sebastian his purse to hold. What kind of purse is that, I wonder? Now, you could read this whole scene as being fairly innocent, except for the fact that Antonio is a wanted man in Illyria. If he stays there, he will die. But he stays anyway, because he is in love with Sebastian. When Sebastian ends up in the same place as his twin sister, neither of them have any idea, and both of them think that the other one is dead, and, you know, hijinks ensue. Viola, his Sebastian's sister, is disguised as Cesario. And when Cesario is dueling with Sir Andrew, Antonio steps in. He wants to help Sebastian. He is willing to be arrested, possibly killed, for his love for Sebastian. And, I mean, it's, yes, in all of these situations, we could read these characters as being straighty 180, but it's not that difficult to read them as queer. And if we allow Shakespeare the courtesy of acknowledging that he was probably queer, why wouldn't he be putting these beautifully bisexual undertones into his storytelling? But let's continue with the subject of Antonio. This time, Antonio in The Merchant of Venice. This is, of course, the play from which we get the idea of asking for your pound of flesh. And before we go any further, I need to acknowledge that The Merchant of Venice has some hideous anti-Semitism in it. I don't think it's a play that really needs to be staged ever again. It's pretty rank. But let's just talk about Antonio for the minute and try to ignore his hideous anti-Semitism. We've got a fair amount of consensus that Antonio is at least homoromantic. There is a beautiful moment in Michael Radford's film adaptation when Antonio shares a kiss with his friend Bassanio, and it's this lovely moment. It turns out the actors who play the two characters don't agree on what the kiss meant, but I'm taking it to mean what we know it means, because Antonio's obsession with Bassanio is beyond what one would expect from just friendship. You know, it's that kind of pedantic, slightly manic obsession that you only really believe comes from a slightly distorted, very, very much unrequited lust or love. I think the beautiful thing about their relationship is it's really difficult to pin down that ambiguity. And Joseph Fiennes, who played Bassiano in the movie, said, you know, he was very comfortable with the kiss and with the idea that the two men may be lovers. And I quote, "I would never invent something before doing my detective work in the text. If you look at the choice of language, you'll read very sensuous language. That's the key for me in the relationship. The great thing about Shakespeare and why he's so difficult to pin down is his ambiguity. He's not saying they're gay or they're straight. He's leaving it up to his actors. I feel there has to be a great love between the two characters. There's great attraction. I don't think they have slept together, but that's for the audience to decide." Now, I'm going to disagree on whether they've slept together, but that's fine. That doesn't determine somebody's sexuality. And I am going to acknowledge and flag and point out and wag my finger at Joseph Fiennes for saying that the options are gay or straight. But, yeah, you know, if it's printed on the internet, it must be true, right? So there you go. I'm calling it. Every character that Shakespeare wrote who is called Antonio is bisexual. Some of them are jerks. Some of them are anti-Semites. Some of them are just confused, privileged weirdos. But all of them are multi-gender attracted. They can't help it. It's just the way they feel. This is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass on Joy.
Spell it out for ya. All of the feelings that I got for ya can't be explained, but I can try for ya. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for ya. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions. Should know by the way I use my compression that you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way.
So good, so good, so fucking real. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
You know my love is so, please don't stop it.
You got me right here in your jean pocket right now. Laying your body on a shag carpet. Ooh. You know my love is so, please don't stop it. It's like I'm
evening, good evening, good evening. It is the last Tuesday of the month, which must mean that I'm Jennifer, and this is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass on Joy. And tonight, we are focusing on the bi-plus characters in Shakespeare. And my word, there are a lot of them. Yes, none of them are confirmed, but you know what? We didn't have the interwebs 400 years ago. People weren't able to go on Tumblr or Twitter and discuss their headcanons until the creators confirmed them as true. So, as per the previous episode of the hour that was all about headcanons, here's by Shakespeare. You're welcome. Let's talk now about Macbeth, specifically about Banquo in Macbeth and how much everyone loves him. Now, we never get to see a Lady Banquo, and I like to think that's in order to leave it free and open for Macbeth and Duncan to lust after the dude. We know that Banquo has had a wife at some stage because Banquo has a son called Fleance. So we know that Banquo will make it with a lady and produce a son that he adores. But let's start off with Banquo's queerness. There is a moment when there's been a big battle. Macbeth has been given a new title by the king, Duncan, and has gone on ahead to get his place ready because everyone's just all of a sudden coming there for a party. They approach Macbeth's castle, and Duncan says, "Oh, yeah, this place looks nice." To which Banquo replies, "This guest of summer, the temple-haunting martlet, does approve. By his loved masonry, that the heaven's breath smells wooingly here. No jutty frieze buttress nor coign of vantage, but this bird hath made his pendant bed and procreant candle. Where they most breed and haunt, I have observed, the air is delicate." Now that's a lot of romance to say about a building. One might go so far as to think Banquo feels very fondly about the person inside the building. And the fact that he finishes with "the air is delicate," and we know that delicacy? To be delicate is to be assumed feminine, and for men to be assumed feminine is for men to be assumed queer. Anyway, we carry on. Later, still in Macbeth's castle, Banquo goes wandering about and comes upon Fleance, his son, and they sit down and have a little chat. And Banquo mostly talks about how everyone's banging. they can't see the moon, they can't see candles, so Banquo's immediate assumption is there's husbandry in heaven. In other words, they've turned out the lights so that they can bang. Now, at this point, the only couple we have seen are Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, which means the people that Banquo must be thinking of first are Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. Given that Banquo and Macbeth have just been off on this huge campaign in a massive war, do you think maybe Banquo is missing the company of his bedfellow? Yeah, you do. You do. You know you do. Well, I do anyway. And then after Macbeth has... Well, Macbeth's killed a bunch of people at this point, but when Macbeth... Oh, do I have to say spoilers for Shakespeare? Look, if you haven't seen the story and after 400 years, I think spoilers are just a given. After Macbeth has started on his killing rampage, he's killed Duncan, he's become king, he's killed a bunch of other people. He starts getting paranoid about Banquo because Banquo is the greatest person he knows. But Macbeth doesn't kill Banquo himself. He hires a couple of murderers to sneak up on him and stab him in the night. Yet he killed Duncan by his own hand. So at this point, bear with me. Macbeth has killed his king, Duncan, whom he has previously expressed massive love for. It's the first time he has killed somebody outside of battle. He is incredibly distressed after the fact. And yet, it's not that ghost that haunts him. It's Banquo. Now, if Banquo's ghost is an hallucination on Macbeth's part, I would suggest that the fact that he is obsessing over somebody who he hasn't actually seen killed, that he sent other people to kill, rather than his king who he killed with his own hand, that might suggest a little connection there. If it is a ghost, apart from Banquo's ghost wanting to wreak havoc on Macbeth, bearing in mind that Banquo doesn't actually know that Macbeth has killed him at this point, why would it be Macbeth that he goes to first? Because he wants help. He goes to find his lover so that he can find the help to figure out what's going on. It's a beautiful, tragic love story. Don't all love stories end with one of them killing the other? Or no? Fair enough. You are on Joy. This is the representation hour for Triple Bypass. I'm taking you right through until 10 o'clock tonight, so stick around. We've still got a little bit to go. This is Sparks and Life with the Macbeths. You're on Joy.
All the dreaming and scheming and playing games are enough to draw millions each week the same. Same station, same time
I'm
Hello, happy Tuesday. I'm Jennifer. This is the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. We are almost at the end of our discussion about how bi Shakespeare's guys are, but we could not talk bi Shakespeare without discussing Horatio. Oh, now Horatio has been front of my mind lately because I am working on a show called Ophelia Thinks Harder. You should all totally come along. It opens on the 9th of November and it's based on Hamlet, which means, of course, that we have a Horatio. There's a great moment in Ophelia Thinks Harder where Horatio starts saying Sonnet 18, Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day, which we know was written to a man. But I'm not going to focus on the Horatio in the play I'm working on. I want to look at the original Horatio. Now, first of all, Horatio's final speech with Prince Fortinbras is one of the funniest alleged proofs of Shakespeare's same-sex attraction I've ever seen. If you find a copy of it and start from I shall have also cause to speak... So it allegedly spells out down the side, I am a homosexual. It takes a fair bit of effort to make that work, but Google it, it'll give you a giggle. But let's look at the speech itself. I shall have also cause to speak, and from his mouth whose voice will draw on more. But let this same be presently performed, even while men's minds are wild, lest more mischance on plots and errors happen. Let four captains bear Hamlet like a soldier to the stage, for he was likely, had he been put on, to have proved most royally. And for his passage, the soldiers' music and the rites of war speak loudly for him. Take up the bodies, such a sight as this becomes the field, but here shows much amiss. Go bid the soldiers shoot. Horatio is essentially saying to Fortinbras, Hamlet was incredibly noble, incredibly loyal, had nothing to do with this massive catastrophe. I don't know how it possibly went wrong because Hamlet is great. Horatio knows that Hamlet has been tormenting Ophelia. He knows that Hamlet put this extra scene into the play at the King and Queen's wedding. He knows Hamlet poisoned all of the goblets. He knows all of this. And yet he still has this incredible tunnel vision about the kind of guy Hamlet is. We also see Horatio just about kill himself when he sees Hamlet dying. Now, if I talk to you, if I ask you what couple in Shakespeare kill themselves because the other is dead, it's Romeo and Juliet. This is a convention that Shakespeare uses for romantic love. So we know in our hearts and guts and souls and minds and loins that Horatio is hot for Hamlet. And you know what? I think Hamlet's probably hot for Horatio as well. But I think both of them have got a little thing for Ophelia. I'm just going to leave it there for them and say, come along and see Ophelia Thinks Harder from the 9th to the 24th of November. That's my very last shameless plug. This has been the Representation Hour for Triple Bypass on Joy. I'm still Jennifer. I'll be Jennifer next month. And I will be back with more bi plus representation in pop culture. And I really hope you can join me. If you've got any great ideas for what you would like me to base a show on, please tweet us at Triple Bypass or email triplebypass@joy.org.au. Thanks for being here with me. Ruby and the gang are back next week with a regular edition of Triple Bypass, and I'll see you soon. Night-night. You're on Joy.
She keeps Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cake, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't take. Cigarettes, well versed in etiquette, extraordinarily nice. She's a killer.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.